Hi, I'm Willie Miller.
Hi, I'm Seth Coe.
I'm Heather Mackett.
Hello, I'm Jonathan Agnew.
Hi, it's Grant Hackett here.
Hi, I'm Sharon Spoon from the Wallaroo.
I'm Azuma Nelson.
I'm Gashin, and you're listening to Not the Footish.
Yes, you are indeed listening to another podcast of Not the Footy Show. And as usual, we've got a guest lined up for you. That will be Sean Norris from the Australian Rollers wheelchair basketball team. And John and I will be discussing a couple of pertinent issues in the world of sport at the moment. But just before we get on to that, I'm Ashley Morrison.
And I'm John Lee.
And I just want to say that some good news for Gary Luscombe, who we had on, I think it was about three podcasts ago, who was raising the money for the Johnny Famishan statue project. They've raised all the money now, and so the statue will be being unveiled in Frankston on the 21st of January next year. So
oh,
fantastic, and congratulations to Gary.
And a great bloke to have immortalised in bronze too.
Absolutely. So I'm hoping to head over for that one. And, yeah, it should be a special day because Azuma Nelson has announced he will be coming over for it. Jeff Fenwick's going to be there. Barry Michaels is going to be there. So there'll be a few former champions in attendance.
I know that's travelling in the country and you don't need a passport or anything, but you can't have much room left in yours at the moment, can you?
Luckily, I have two. So I had to get a new Australian one because the last trip I did, I think it was earlier in the year, I've gone through immigration leaving the country and I got pulled across by immigration. They said, this is the last trip you're doing on this passport. And I'm like, why? There's like something like 5 years remaining. And they said, it's got a rip in it. We're cancelling it as of your return. So you will not be able to travel on it once you get back. So I've literally got a brand new one now. So
that's what you need. Every couple of years, just put a little tear in it. Oh, I need a new one.
And not the price it costs, John.
No, that's a good point.
And also, I was flying out, I think, within a week. So yeah. It was, yeah, pretty hard. Anyway, we should probably turn to the first topic. And I'm going to turn my attention to the Socceroos. Obviously, it's been a big issue of late. First of all, I would just like to say that nobody has a divine right to qualify for a World Cup. And anybody that thought that Australia was just going to waltz through because we're playing in Asia, we're better than everyone in Asia, nice wake-up call. About time you woke up. Now, a lot of people have been throwing criticism at Ange Postecoglou. I wrote a piece on the website, notthefootyshow.com. And to me, the FFA are as culpable if Ange is culpable. I don't think he actually is culpable personally. But the thing is, they should have noticed, as anyone in football would have noticed, that the talent wasn't there 4 years ago because they weren't developing the players. Their development program has been a disaster. And we're only just beginning to realize that now, that the talent is not coming through. And the other thing I would say about that is they have put all their eggs on us qualifying for the World Cup. 15 million we get if we qualify. I'd like to know what the FFA is going to do if we don't qualify, if we don't beat Syria and then Honduras, USA or Panama, because they're banking on that 15 million to run the game for the next 4 years. Now, realistically, this was always going to be a difficult campaign, and now they're facing the possibility, they've got the added costs of playing in the playoffs, but now they've got the possibility that we may not get to Russia. And therefore, what are they going to do? Where's the money going to come from? Or what programs are they going to cut? Tell us now, because, you know, but I think the problems are that they've got nobody in there running the game who actually knows the game. And that's why they didn't identify the fact that the development program wasn't working. But going back to that, okay, people have criticized Ange Postecoglou for changing the way they played during the qualification process. That's up to him. He's the coach. If you watch some international coaches, they will change the setup depending on the opposition, you know, because yeah. It will suit them to get the result. Now, maybe that's where he is at fault, that sometimes he's played a formation and it's not got the result. I think the key result was the draw in Thailand. That killed the campaign, and that's probably why we didn't qualify. But to me, what we have to look at is the performance of the players.
Absolutely.
Everything they did in that game, to have 45 shots hit the woodwork three times, they won against Thailand, which is a good result. They beat Thailand. What it shows is Asia is improving. Now, Thailand threw their bodies at everything. Credit to them. They did not want to lose that game. They were in there fighting for everything. But where was the composure of these players that we have that are supposedly playing in better leagues around the world? Where was their execution of their skills? Tom Rogic is a wonderful player, but, you know, again, some of his shooting was going into row Z. Lecky is the one I have the biggest complaint about, in that he's getting all these raps about how great a player he is, yet his delivery into the penalty area is diabolical. The amount of balls he put in there that the Thai player got to first, you know, he, if he is a quality player, should be able to pick out a man in green and gold. And he didn't manage to do that. And so to me, Mark Milligan was the one player I felt that could walk out of that game with his head held high. And if we look at it, Australia were very lucky because there should have been a penalty against them. But to me, it's the players, the quality of the players, their ability to execute. And I think Thailand gave them a lesson in their first touch ball control was far superior. And yet we're meant to have this wonderful development program. And the one other thing I will add is Robbie Cruz, if ever you wanted an example of why the going to China is going to make your career go backwards, Robbie Cruz is a prime example. In the last two games against Japan and against Thailand, where's the Robbie Cruz of old? I mean, in my book, he's finished as an international player.
I was staggered by the amount of vitriol that was thrown at the coach and the fact that the players seemed to escape virtually criticism-free. Yet they were the ones that missed goals. They were the ones that didn't show any composure. Formation's fine. 40-odd shots on goal, and you're telling me there's something wrong with the formation?
That's the thing. I mean, if you look at it, Ange has done everything right. Yeah. They had 45 shots. The responsibility has to fall back on the players.
Absolutely. And all of those players would know that. If there's one player there who's thinking, oh, well, Ange didn't do a good job, you better leave now, mate, because you're not going to be any use to the next coach either.
Yeah, look, I mean, I know Ange Postecoglou, having dealt with him as a coach, having worked alongside him at Fox, and he can be prickly, there is no doubt. And he is a different personality to a lot of other people you will ever meet. But I think, you know, how can he go from hero to suddenly the biggest villain there is in 2 years? My argument still, and I've upset a lot of people, is that Asian Cup victory, it was nothing to really boast about. The Asia Cup is not a good competition, and there were only ever four teams that were ever going to win that tournament. So if you look at that in reality, if those four teams all make the semi-finals, you've really got to win two games, which they did, and they did it hard against South Korea in the final.
Yeah.
But what happened with that victory was it papered over the cracks of how we're lacking the talent in this country to compete and really be one of the top footballing nations.
Well, when we first joined Asia, it was so we could avoid the South Americans through the Oceania qualifying. But if they honestly thought that Asia was not going to get better and that it would just give them the straight clean through run that being part of Oceania was, they were kidding themselves. I mean, you already had Korea, Japan. Throw in China into the mix because they're just going to improve in the next few years unbelievably.
And then you've got Iran, Saudi Arabia,
exactly.
Jordan is still up there, you know. There's a lot of very good teams. And, and again, I think Australia just... I do think, sadly, John, because the FFA had people from outside of the game in key management roles, they genuinely believed that this was now a given because there were four qualification spots and a playoff position, that Australia now was guaranteed to be at every World Cup.
It's not turning out to be that way, is it? And what's going on with the Australian media, football media, the way that they protected the players following that game? You know, don't tell me that Tim Cahill should still be there. The fact that Tim Cahill is there shows how weak the Australian setup really is.
Absolutely, and in my opinion, he should have received a yellow card early in the match for the challenge he put on the Thai defender. I mean, it was late, it was high, and it was probably only because he was Tim Cahill that he didn't get a card, that the referee was intimidated that he was a player that had played at the level he had. But I agree 100%. You know, you're paying this guy a lot of money to be in the A-League, but he is not good enough now. Yes, he's come off the bench and he's scored the goals that have saved us in this campaign on several occasions. But as you say, if you're putting all your hope in a man who's 36 years of age, that's sad.
And that's not about Tim Cahill. I mean, all players get to the stage like that. At some, whether you're playing Z grade and you finally get to the end of your Z grade career, or whether you're playing at his level, the fact that he is still the number one pick is incredible. And it does show that lack of depth that we have in our game here. But there's other players that got away scot-free. It was all Ange. Now, what's the link between some of these commentators and the players? Are some of these guys managers? Do they have the same manager? It was just extraordinary that no player, not one player, was signalled out and said, well, they had a poor game, or they should have done better, or their time's up. It was all about Ange.
Yeah.
Whether they do that deliberately and Ange goes around to the media and says, look, boys, ping me, leave the boys alone, just have a crack at me and I'll be fine with that. Who's to know? But it seemed like the commentary was very biased in one direction and not, what's the word for it? It didn't actually sum up the game as it happened.
But the thing that I found quite sad is it showed, as you say, maybe Ange has said, you know, have a go at me rather than the players. But were they united? I mean, how many of the players have actually come out in defence of Ange? I actually haven't heard anyone come out and say, you know, that he shouldn't have copped the abuse that he has.
Well, what was interesting was Mark Bosnich's comments. Not that he made them, but that he made the reference to what happened here in Perth between Ange and the FFA over comments he made. Now, surely that's not still lingering in the air behind the scenes. They must have had to have dealt with that at some stage. And if you are still harbouring after that amount of time something, then you've got to question yourself.
Look, I think we talked about it on one of the podcasts. I think that was handled diabolically.
Yeah, it was.
You know, the fact that they made him publicly apologise to me was the wrong move. Like, what they should have done, and I think, yes, that knowing Ange the way I do, and I don't know him very, very well. I just know him sort of quite well, having worked with him. No, but I don't know him very well. Like, I mean, I could sit down and have a coffee with him, yeah, but I wouldn't be ringing him up every week saying, hey, how are you going, Ange? Well done, Ange, you know, all of that. But I just know that would have annoyed him, that would have really got under his skin. Now, what it should have been is Gallup should have called him into a room, given him a serious kick up the backside and said, you are employed by us, you don't criticise us. And it should have been done behind closed doors, not publicly. And he should not have been humiliated by having to apologise like a naughty schoolboy. And I think that it was horribly wrong. And I think that would still upset him. I believe, and my sources tell me, that his contract won't be renewed. So maybe in the background there's that as well, that he knows that he needs to have a good World Cup campaign to get them to the World Cup, to showcase his own skills, to be able to get a job after the Socceroos. I mean, there is talk. But also, you go on the media, and if you looked, it was very interesting that the Sydney-based media were very much the stronger ones on his back. Now, OK, Ange comes from Melbourne. You could turn it into that. But I don't think it was about that. I think what it was is Graham Arnold's done a great job with the Sydney media, having him as their spokespersons. And I think that they were pushing for him to come in at the 11th hour and become the hero and take over from Ange and get us to the World Cup and then take us to the World Cup. So I think there was an underlying thing going on by certain sections of the media that were trying to get their man in Sydney in ahead at the last minute to claim all the glory. And that's just my personal...
With respect to Graham Arnold, because he's doing a fantastic job at Sydney, he's had his time.
Yeah, to be fair to him, I think, though, he wasn't ready then. I think he's matured now as a coach and as a human being, and I think he actually is in a better position now than he was when he did it before. It's interesting because you talk about that with England and Bobby Robson, you know, who did a great job with England. He always said he wanted the job again about 10 years after he'd lost it because he felt, again, he was better experienced now to be able to do the job.
Yeah.
But, of course, they never went back to him because often they don't go back to the same people.
Well, sometimes you can't. Sometimes you've got to keep moving forward. And if you go backwards, it appears that way. It's a mindset of backwards. Yeah, I don't think Ange has got the full backing of the FFA.
No, I don't think he has,
and that's causing problems. And it goes back to the situation in Perth because suddenly now the players are going, well, he's getting told off. Who is actually the boss here? And players need to know the coach is the man that's in charge, and they answer to the coach, and they answer to no one else but the coach. Now, that's not the situation. There's this other thing that's hanging above the coach. So why do we have to worry about what he says? Because he's not actually the boss. There's other people that are going to make those decisions.
Well, I don't know if you watched the game, but I couldn't believe the cast of thousands on the bench. It's like, who the hell were all those people? I mean, surely it should just be the players, the physio, the assistant coach, maybe the assistant goalkeeping coach. But there was Josip Gombau was there. There was every man and his dog that was involved in coaching in the FFA was sitting on the bench. And I mean, I don't know whether they all wanted to be in a photo opportunity when we qualified for the World Cup. But to me, if I was the head coach, I'd be going, no, you're not here, you're not here, but only these three or four people.
What did Thailand have to take out of the game?
Nothing, just pride.
They just had pride to play for.
Yep.
Mm. Very interesting, that.
Yeah, difference, isn't it?
Yeah.
Hi, I'm Mark Leduca, and you're listening to Not The Footy Show.
Yes, you are listening to Not The Footy Show, and time for us to introduce our guest, and that is Sean Norris from the Australian Rollers. Now, if you followed Not The Footy Show right back from its very beginning back in 2005, you will have known that we followed the Australian Rollers wheelchair basketball since those very, very early days. And the team has had great success. They've won world championships. They've won Olympic, Paralympic gold medals. But at Rio, it was a real disappointment. They went out in the quarterfinals to Great Britain, and it was a real body blow to the sport, to the athletes, to the coaches, and to those of us who were following wheelchair basketball. But I'm pleased to say they're back at two winning ways after a good tournament recently in Japan. And so we thought we'd catch up with a man who, after Rio, contemplated retirement, Sean Norris. Sean Norris, welcome back to Not The Footy Show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me back.
Well, it's been a while since we had a chat, and I think if I remember rightly, the last time we spoke was soon after the Rio Olympics, and it was a disappointing tournament for the Australian Rollers, and you were actually considering retirement because of injury and obviously the disappointment of that performance.
Yeah, it's, you know, I think looking back on everything now, I think I was very spoilt in my career so far leading up to Rio, you know, winning world championships, you know, always sort of being in that grand final match in the Paralympics until Rio. Yeah, I guess it was a tough pill to swallow, and knowing myself and my motivation levels after Rio being quite low, after we did do so bad, I don't know, I've had some time now to reflect on it all, and I guess now I have some more appreciation of what I've been able to accomplish in the past. But yeah, it was tough to get back on the bike, for sure.
And I mean, it wasn't as if it suddenly all clicked back into place, because it's also been a tough year for the Perth Wildcats as well, with a lot of retirements there and new faces coming in. And in fact, there were a lot of positives, because a young team with little experience actually held their own against some really experienced sides.
Yeah, for sure, absolutely. And yeah, as I said, like, it's sort of changing. I know now I'm getting towards the end of my career, and I've got to look at things differently. But also I find a new challenge in the sense that there's some new kids coming through, and some older guys that are just starting wheelchair basketball as well, that, you know, sort of taking as a, you know, a bit of a challenge and challenging myself to try and teach them what I know as well. So we've done quite well, I would say. We didn't do well this season. Not making finals is a little bit disappointing, but there was a weekend there where I missed a few games, and unfortunately we lost. Potentially we could have won and made finals. But in saying that, I think we got a lot out of this season with the new guys, specifically Tom Q, Andrew Dewberry, and there's a new guy, Lavalli. He only had his accident last year, actually. He's joined the team. And sort of teaching those guys the ropes and where we want to go, we saw some really positive signs from them. So I'm quite happy, and potentially I think next year is going to be even better.
No, it certainly looked that was going to be the case, so let's hope it is the way it comes out. Now, you've just returned from Japan, where you were playing back on board with the Australian Rollers, and a really successful tournament at the World Challenge Cup, where first up, it must have been good to beat the hosts.
Yeah, it was really good. You know, sort of going through the story, so we've looked at some new ideas and lineups within the Australian team, sort of you know, we know now what was happening in Rio didn't really work, and we got to do some homework, some research, some hard work, potentially just to change some lineups within the team. So, you know, we had a couple of days of training beforehand, and we were trying some new lineups, and you know, it all looked really good in the lead up and the training, and you know, everything felt good with the new lineup. And then we started the first game, and we were absolutely getting smashed in the first quarter. I think we were down by like 13, and I was just thinking, like, what is happening? This does not feel right. So yeah, I think we were down by 20 or so at half time, and I don't know. I guess coming back into the third quarter with that original lineup, that starting five, we really got going. I guess we really needed that time to flesh things out, considering it was our only our first tournament together with some of the new guys and that lineup. And yeah, just came back for an amazing win in the end from 20 down. So some really positive signs there.
The other thing was the next game you had a doubleheader, two games in the same day, and it looked from the result or the score, the patterns of the scoring, that you were probably a little bit fatigued after that performance against Japan, against Great Britain.
Yeah, a little bit. We had to put in a lot of effort in that Japan game, but in saying that, you know, a lot of the guys, and I think definitely in the new lineup, there's a lot of new energy within the team, and a lot of people picking up a lot of the slack and carrying their own. So, quite positive, to be honest, overall. I know that for myself, I'm in a little bit of a weird spot at the moment because I've got to work full time, and it's really hard to try and train as much as I should be. Considering, you know, got things I got to pay and, you know, all the boring stuff in life that you got to do every day. But yeah, trying to find myself right balance is a real challenge right now.
Well, that was a good win though, 56-50 over Great Britain. You then had to beat Turkey just to confirm your place in the final, which you did that reasonably easy, which set up a final against Great Britain. And I believe the Prime Minister was actually there.
Yeah, Theresa May was there. It's quite. I didn't even realise till after the game. You know, the game finished, and I guess that's how focused I was. I didn't even really think about it. And to see that she was actually on the sidelines watching the game, and that we've just beaten GB was pretty funny. I think the funniest part was though, one of the boys in the team they put up a Twitter post and tagged Theresa and Malcolm Turnbull in it. I can't remember exactly the comment, but it was pretty funny. But good for wheelchair basketball that should come down and watch a game and support us like that.
Absolutely. I mean, you touch on that, and obviously that gave publicity back in the UK. Do you get much publicity here still, or is it still a real struggle to get the media to pick up on the fact that you win a tournament like this?
I think it's getting better. I have a feeling after Rio, because we didn't do so well, unfortunately, we're not. Maybe not where we were a couple of years ago. But in saying that, I never played basketball for the fame or fortune. It's always been for the love of the game. And, you know, if that sort of stuff comes along and media and support for the program, more for the fact that allowing us to do what we want to do and be professional athletes. The end goal is always, you know, if we could be paid full-time athletes that didn't have to worry about going to work, you know, that would be the ultimate dream. But, just play it for the love of the game.
Yeah, we lost you for a little bit there, but no problems. I mean, I suppose the biggest thing, isn't it, is you'd love the sponsorship dollars that would ease some of the financial burden, but then in order to get sponsors, you need to get media coverage.
Yeah, that's it. It goes around that. I understand that, like, if you want to put something in, you got to get something back as a supporter or a sponsor. Definitely totally on board with that. I guess it's just unfortunate for me. It's maybe against my nature, and I sort of understand that now that I don't really like talking about myself personally. But that's fine. I understand it.
Now, you mentioned, obviously, that the fact that there were some new faces, new structures within the Australian Rollers, and obviously those new faces have really stepped up. I mean, some of them have been around the National Wheelchair Basketball League for a while, but it's great that they're finally cementing their place in the national team.
Yeah, I think it's also with the new coaching staff, and you know, there's a lot of things changing within the program that sort of allows these people to have opportunities that potentially they didn't have before. And obviously, after Rio, something has to change. You just can't keep going like we were before. So something, yeah. Unless we were happy and satisfied with, you know, coming into the same spot that we were, say, were before, yeah, we had to change it. So, and it's good that people and players are responding to it, and people have been given opportunities to prove themselves.
Looking back now, and they say hindsight is perfect vision, can you see that the writing was maybe on the wall that Rio wasn't going to be as successful as it had been for the Rollers in the past? Or is it one of those things that only now, after the event, you go, oh, maybe we should have noticed that then?
Yeah, as you said, hindsight is amazing. And I guess talking after the fact, I did have a feeling, to be honest, that something wasn't quite right. I didn't know to what extent. It was two things for me, like having lost, in my opinion, two players, in Justin and Michael. Losing them too, I always knew that people had to step up. I had to step up. And the things that they do for the team, I mean, you know, I've been around it for a long time, so I sort of have an understanding of how much they contribute to the team. But yeah, it was an unknown quantity. I didn't know exactly how big it was going to be. You know, a game or two into Rio, that's when I really realised that, yeah, this something's really not right. But ever the optimist, I guess, you always believe that, you know, you can turn it around. And I've always believed, as a player, it's up to you as an individual within a team to make a difference. I never thought, you know, it was anyone else's fault but mine. And I think definitely in the situation, at that point in time, it had to be that way because nothing was going to change fundamentally. You just had to give everything you got.
And do you feel now that things are back on track? I mean, obviously, Justin Everson, Michael Hartnett weren't involved in this tournament, but you got the result. You beat everybody that you came up against, and, you know, it must be good to be back on the winner's podium.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. It's something I've been really thinking about a lot, especially since the tournament ended in Japan. Some change of fundamentals of what it means to be a roller as a player, and the things that we focus on. It feels like we've really become defensively orientated, which is really nice and refreshing. I don't think we've been there for a very, very long time. Yeah, it's really difficult to explain. I think with the new lineups that we're trying, I think it's heading in the right direction. It definitely feels good right now. I feel like we're definitely heading in the right direction. It feels almost like it was in the past, like 4 or 5 years ago. I guess that motivation is coming back because you can sort of see that this is potentially going to work. Obviously, you have to make it work when it counts, because at the end of the day, it's not really a friendly tournament in Japan at this time of the year that you're really aiming for. You know, you want to go for a World Champs or a Paralympics where it really counts, but yeah, it feels like we're on the right track.
Well, the big one next up for you, I think, is the Asia-Oceania qualifiers for the World Cup next year, isn't it? And that's in Beijing in October, and that's probably when you're going to really find out where you're at.
Yeah. The only unfortunate, well, it's not unfortunate, I don't mean to be rude, but, you know, we're playing some of the less ranked teams in the world, besides, you know, Japan, Korea, Iran, they're going to be strong in our pool. But yeah, I guess more opportunity. I think as you said before, the fact that we played against GB, we played them in the pool rounds and beat them by 7, then played them again in the finals, which is good, and beat them by 20-something. That sort of, in my mind, solidified the fact that we're heading in the right direction. I think in the past, I don't know how much we lost to them by in Rio. I don't know if it was 10 or 20 points. That's almost a 40-point turnaround. Even if they didn't really, even if they were a little bit underdone, and I don't know their program and where all those players are at this point in time, so I'll give them the benefit of the doubt that I don't think in the future it's going to be as easy as a 20-point win. But the fact that we did do that, that to me says more than anything. And then, yeah, I guess in the qualifiers coming up, we can refine that and have more opportunity for us to be able to play together and find out who we are as a team now.
Well, Sean, always good to catch up with you, and congratulations to you and everyone at the Rollers for that win, and we'll keep an eye on how you're progressing, and maybe next year it will be another World Championship for the Rollers.
Thanks, mate. Thanks for having me.
Hi, I'm Seb Coe, and you're listening to Not The Footy Show.
Yes, welcome back to Not The Footy Show. That was Sean Norris from the Australian Rollers, and I don't think you could get a more frank and honest interview, and it is great that he is getting his mojo back on the basketball court, and also great that the Australian Rollers are beginning to get back to winning ways. New coach, a lot of new players coming in, and a new vibe in the team, and that's great, and let's hope that next year they can get later in the year, they can qualify for the World Cup, and who knows, maybe even reclaim the World Cup title and bring it back to Australia.
Oh, for sure. And you need sometimes you need that changeover. Sometimes you need that bad result, because when you've had a lot of success for a long time, everything seems good, and you just need that one to break things up, to make you change and suddenly realise, okay, yes, we were good, but that's not going to work in the future because everybody else has caught up to us. So we've got to make systemic changes.
And I think the other thing was they had some pretty special players in Justin Everson, Brad Ness, Michael Hartnett. You know, they were special players, and you don't get a generation. It's like a generation of those players come along once in a lifetime, and we were lucky that we had them for that sort of 10-year period. And now we've got to rebuild without them.
And very often you find that when sports, clubs, teams, whatever, have had that great run of success, when that success leaves them, suddenly the players that are there seem worse than what they actually are. I mean, if you finish, you could finish fourth or third, but it's still seen as being a bad result compared to that golden generation.
Absolutely.
And that's something that maybe football's had to put up with too.
Yeah, success at the highest level is very, very hard to come by.
Yeah, and it's even harder to maintain. It's easier to get to the top than it is to stay at the top.
Very true. Well, now it's your turn to raise a topic.
Oh, shall we go with the obvious? Western Force, farce, whatever you want to call it. I'm going with the farce at the moment. It is staggering what's happening in Australian rugby. $50 million. That's all you need to say is $50 million. An English Premier League club wouldn't say no to that. But apparently, the Australian Rugby Union can.
Yeah, I think the thing that worries me, and I've written a piece again on the website, notthefootyshow.com, about how the Senate inquiry that has now been passed, and Linda Reynolds, the WA senator, put forward for that investigation into the ARU. Look, I think there needed to be an investigation into the ARU and how they reached the decision they did, because it sounds, from what we're hearing and what we know, that I don't think due process was followed.
Oh,
I think they made
not.
A decision a long, long time ago. I've actually seen a text message that was sent to one of the coaches that applied for the job a year ago, and that said that they realised then that they were facing the possibility of being thrown out at the end of this season. So the board knew about this. My question there is, so what did they do about it a year ago to try and prevent this? Was a phone call made to Andrew Forrest then?
No.
And my understanding is the person that made the phone call to Andrew Forrest was actually not from Rugby WA. It was a private citizen who is a big rugby fan who made the phone call and got Forrest engaged. Now, that's the sources I've got, that I've been told that this person made the call and doesn't wish to be it made public who he was. But again, that I find really interesting, that it came from somebody outside of that club. But the big problem I have now is okay, if the Force are going to be leaving Super Rugby and they're going to have this Indo-Pacific League, this Indo-Pacific League will not happen unless Andrew Forrest gets the approval of World Rugby. He needs to be on a plane now, or on the phone call, or on however he wants to communicate with World Rugby, saying, will you sanction this competition? Because if they don't sanction it, and the ARU and maybe even New Zealand Rugby go to the World Rugby and say, hey, we don't want this competition, it's going to really damage ours, and we're not going to pick any player that plays in this competition for our national teams, suddenly it's dead in the water. But the thing that they have in their advantage is Fiji are currently playing in the national rugby competition in Australia. Now, what a lot of people don't know is World Rugby are paying all their airfares to participate in the competition and all the airfares of all the teams from Australia that are going to go to Fiji and play their matches. Now, this is what World Rugby is doing to try and help Fiji Rugby. Now, we've talked about this for a long time, that the money hasn't been invested in the island nations. Now, if Andrew Forrest comes in and suddenly says, hey, you're not going to have to pay that money anymore because I'm going to be paying it, because I'm going to be running this Indo-Pacific League, the World Rugby is going to go, oh, thank you very much. That's going to save us a lot of money. We can put that money somewhere else. So this is what I find at the moment, and I was at the game at the weekend, you know, against the Springboks, and I could find nobody who could clarify. And in fact, I was at lunch on the Friday with Andrew Forrest, with Alan Jones, all those sort of high rollers that are kind of pushing for this new league. And I'm amazed that they haven't already got the support of World Rugby. Before I made an announcement, I would have made sure that they endorsed it, so that you knew that every player still was eligible to be picked for their country playing in that competition, and that it had the seal of approval. Otherwise, it becomes a rebel competition, and we all know what happens to rebel competitions.
Yeah, although it might just be the rebel competition that can help shake it up, much the same way that World Series cricket did. I mean, that's one of the few rebel competitions that's actually benefited a sport. So you're right, the chances are that it'll just make things worse for rugby in this country.
Yeah, I think what you're going to see, exactly, I mean, I agree World Series was the only one, but there was a lot of pain that those players absolutely went through to prove their point. And in fact, the game went through, and luckily Kerry Packer stuck to his guns and, you know, got through all of that. But what I think you're going to see is, I like we saw with the old Soccer Australia, is the ARU, they're not going to relinquish their grip. But I think you're going to see two bodies for a while running the game in Australia. And it's going to be a war of attrition until one of them just falls over, or World Rugby steps in and says, look, enough of this. We need one power running the game in Australia, or you're going to be excluded from the World Cup or excluded from the Olympic Games. Sort it out. Which one of you is going to do it?
Well, that's an interesting noise there. It just comes across the computer. We'll have to suss that out later. I don't get the feeling that the ARU is competent to run any sort of competition, quite frankly. I mean, here's the CEO coming. Was it the CEO coming out and saying, "Oh, well, you know, it was too late for Forrest's money. It was too late. You know, he came forward too late." Well, mate, you came out in what was April and dropped it on us that you were going to dump a team, and you were going to tell everybody in a week. 4 months later.
I mean, the thing that gets me is how suddenly they couldn't negotiate to buy the license back off the Melbourne Rebels when it was privately owned, and then suddenly it's sold for a dollar to the Victorian Rugby Union.
Who paid the debt? Because there was a mile high pile.
But also, John, I think we alluded to it again on this podcast. We said, I bet you that there are government incentives that they will play test matches in Melbourne for X amount of years. And lo and behold, what was announced a week later? And I think that needs to come out in the Senate inquiry, and let's find out the full extent, because the Senate inquiry, there will be no more hiding behind non-disclosure in contracts. Those will have to be tabled, and they will be, the people at the Senate inquiry will see all the details.
And I get really, really sick of hearing these non-disclosure commercial reality, commercial stuff from sporting bodies, because you're representing us. We are the stakeholders in this game, and we deserve to know. Don't have your little secret deals with your backhanded mates and all that sort of stuff. which has obviously been going on because of the arrangements that have been made. Be open and front and out and honest with what you're doing, you know, and your arrangements you make.
You're absolutely right, because I find it incredible now how many sponsorship deals with sporting organisations we're never disclosed how much money is involved.
Or the conditions under which that those are going to operate.
You know, I've asked David Gallup a couple of times, how much does Westfield pay into the Westfield Matildas to be known as the Westfield Matildas? Oh, we're not allowed to disclose that. Well, why not?
That's complete rubbish. That makes a mockery of our support of your sport.
But also, when you have the chairman of your board works for that company, to me, that is essential that you disclose it, because there is a massive conflict of interest.
Huge conflict of interest.
So therefore, there you should be above board, open, it should be on the table. This is what we're paying, and they should even at the annual report produce receipts and everything.
I would have thought it was incumbent upon them to be have those sorts of things open to their members. If I'm a member of a football club here in Perth, say Sorrento, I'm a member. I'm also a member of the FFA by default, because I pay fees and subscriptions to the FFA. So as a member of the FFA, I want to know that information. You shouldn't be allowed to hide that from me.
But this is where they've been very clever, the way they've structured football, and we've gone slightly off track from the Western Force, because in fact it is Sorrento are members of Football West. Football West are the member body that has the vote for the board at the Football Federation of Australia level.
The point I'm getting at is...
I know the point you're making.
If the FFA decided they didn't want me, John Lee, playing soccer, they could just deregister me, regardless of what Football West thought or what my club thought. Okay, they have the power to do that. So I'm affiliated to them. If they've got that power over me, I also have the right to know what's going on financially with the organisation.
Absolutely, but legally I think you'd find it would be a difficult one to try and state your case.
Anytime someone goes commercial confidence, it's secret squirrel's time and they're hiding something. If they didn't need to hide something, they'd be just come out and tell you. What is so important that you need to hide it from your stakeholders?
Now, just going back to the Force thing, I don't know if you've seen as well that the Barbarians are going to be playing against the Wallabies, and Alan Jones is going to be the coach, and they're going to call it the Force Wallabies, and they're going to be wear the Western Force socks. Now, personally, I think two things on this. One is, I think it is wrong. As much as I want the Western Force to survive, I don't think you should be messing around with the history of a club like the Barbarians for political gain. That is not what they are about, and I think it is horribly wrong. And also, what about those players who want to wear the thing about the Barbarians is you get to wear the club socks you choose. Now, if a player doesn't want to wear the Force socks, now they're being almost shanghaied into wearing it. But I think if you were going to do that, then why make an announcement in advance that this is what you're going to do? Just do it when you announce your team or whatever. But I just think that this has been the Barbarians have been shanghaied, and my personal view is if I was involved with the Barbarians, I would say, listen, you're not doing that, or the game will be cancelled, or you do it the way the traditions of the Barbarians have always been, or the game doesn't happen.
What did you make of the test match? Not the game itself, but I mean, good on the people for getting out there and putting your blue jersey on, whatever, but, you know, at the end of the day, the AAU cares nothing for you and cares nothing for the game here, except if you want to buy a ticket to a Wallabies test. And you won't be buying a ticket to a Kiwi Wallaby. It won't be the All Blacks that you'll ever see in Perth. No, no, they're going to keep that little cash cow for the Eastern States.
Look, I thought in terms of the colours, it was a fantastic protest in that there was way, way more blue. Like the whole stadium was pretty much blue, and you could pick out the individual people wearing Wallabies gold. So that in that respect, it was really good. But if you ever want to know how the media distort things, it said one of the media reports, I won't say which station, said throughout the game, the Force fans chanted Force. What a load of rubbish.
That would be Channel 7, wouldn't it?
I'm not disclosing which channel it was. But literally, they chanted Force for probably about a minute and a half at the start of the game.
Yeah.
They did it for about a minute at the start of the second half, and then I would think probably about another minute halfway through the second half. So in total, I would think 4 minutes of the game, there was a chant, maybe five, there was a chant of force going around the ground. But in that respect, yeah, it was... Look, the point was made. The great thing was every time a Force player got the ball, the cheer was greater for them than anybody else, and that sent a pretty good message. It was great that Tatafo Polodinau, who from the Force scored a try, so that was really good. As an actual game of rugby, it was possibly the most dire game I've watched for a very long time. It was dull. It was the first half was consign it to history. It was dreadful.
Fair enough. I didn't actually see the game. I was too busy celebrating the final victory. Just winning that lazy second premiership in a row. Just had to squeeze it in there, sorry.
And that's probably the time to finish. Congratulations, John.
Thanks.
Some people are on the pitch. They think it's all over.
See ya. We'll be back next week.